is integrally related to this course, despite the fact that a good portion of his life was not actually in the role of a parish minister, speaking of Walter Rauschenbusch, because of the enormous influence he had had over American Christianity's social thought. Certainly he was among the few who ran counter to the prevailing tendencies of his time. You will recall that the major period of his ministry, which was so often a writing ministry, came in the first decades of this century and followed quickly upon the heels of Henry Ward Beecher, Phillips Brooks, and the other preachers of the late 19th century. Now, I think Rauschenbusch is very important for us because he provides a connecting link between the older tradition of the American churches and the new evangelicalism that was beginning to arise out of a chastened liberalism during the 1930s and 40s. Now, by the 20th century, the older evangelicalism had actually moved in two directions. On the one hand, a revivalism had largely been rendered devoid of content, with theological tags being substituted for serious theological inquiry, and it had also degenerated into institutionalized procedures for obtaining a highly individualistic salvation. The reviving humanitarian concern of the 19th century evangelicalism had been largely divorced from a nurturing theological understanding that could provide it with structural support. Now, the social gospel, as a characteristic expression of American religion, actually began to go in those years shortly after the close of the Civil War. There were some remnants of it even then. In larger measure, it was the church's response to the rapidly expanding industrialism of the post-war period, the increasing tension between labor and capital period, the widening breach between irresponsible wealth on the one hand and insufferable poverty on the other, leading, of course, to growing indifference and to mounting hostility to the church on the part of a great many people among the masses. Now, among the myriad voices raised in the advocacy and exposition of the social gospel, the clearest and the most compelling was, of course, undoubtedly, Walter Rauschenbusch. In the estimation of Reinhold Niebuhr, Rauschenbusch stands, actually, not only as the founder of social Christianity in this country, but also as its most brilliant and permanently satisfying exponent to the present day. Henry Pitney Van Dusen, who was formerly the president of Union Seminary in New York City, thinks that in a 50-year period, he has influenced the life and the thought of the church in our country more than any other single individual. Now, this is, of course, his opinion, but he said, actually, in his judgment, the three most influential figures in American church history from the thought of the church have been Jonathan Edwards, Horace Bushnell, and Walter Rauschenbusch. Since Rauschenbusch was a Baptist, I think we can say that today we're dealing with one of those persons who can make us proud of our tradition. You look at some of them and you want to hang your head. But we're dealing with a man today that can at least make us proud to be a Baptist. Actually, he came upon his greatness, I guess you would say, by inadvertence. He was the seventh in a line of ministers, some of them had achieved notable distinction. He came out of a family that was deeply rooted in Pietism. His father and his grandfather had been Lutheran pastors in Westphalia, in Germany. Rauschenbusch's father came to this country in the disturbed decade of the 1840s. He came here as a missionary to his fellow Germans who had immigrated here. And shortly after his arrival in America, he became a Baptist. And then in 1858, he began to teach history and other subjects in the German department of the Rochester Theological Seminary. And this was a post that he retained for some 30 years. So far as we know, he was an able teacher. He was strongly evangelical. Looked at from our vantage point, he would be deemed quite conservative. Well, Walter Rauschenbusch was born in Rochester, New York on October 4th, 1861. And he died in 1918. So his date would be 1861 to 1918. From all that we can know of his background, his mother was a person who, as we would say today, had quality. And from her, he derived his urbanity, his strongly pronounced sense of humor, his intense love of nature, his habit of close observation. The home atmosphere in which he was reared had a strong religious tone. It centered about the church and the Sunday school and the family altar. It nurtured old-fashioned piety, but I suppose we would say today it was lacking in social vision. Well, when the young Rauschenbusch was just a little boy, 3.5 years old, his mother returned to Germany, and there she remained for the next 4 years. So he began his schooling, actually, in the land of his forefathers, and then he came later to continue it at an academy in Rochester, New York. 4 more years were spent in travel and study in Germany, and then he graduated with first honors from the Evangelical Gymnasium of Gütersloh in Westphalia, and then he spent a part of a year at the University of Berlin. Well, returning to Rochester, then he simultaneously took his senior year at the University of Rochester and his first year at Rochester Theological Seminary. He graduated from the university in 1884, and then from the German department in the seminary of those days. They had the German department, as it was called. Well, he was graduated from the German department of the seminary, and then from the English division in the year 1886. At this time, he had made his decision that he would go as a missionary to India. But one of the professors in the theological seminary objected to his liberal views on the Old Testament, so he was deemed unworthy to go to the mission field by virtue of that. And to add to his impact, at that moment there was a church in Springfield, Illinois, that also rejected him. Well, when the Baptist board refused to appoint him as a missionary, and he was cut off from the foreign mission field, Rauschenbusch then went, and I think this is familiar to most of you who know his story, he went then to accept the pastorate of a small German church in New York City, adjoining that area of the city that was popularly known as Hell's Kitchen. Now, we are told that his congregation was made up almost entirely of working people. They were part of that vast flood of cheap labor drawn from the reservoirs of Europe and then crowded into the tenements of New York City. I had a very interesting conversation some years ago with an old Jewish man with whom I shared a hospital room for several weeks in New Jersey. And he had come to this country from what was then called Russia, Poland. Like all the immigrants of those days, he arrived at Ellis Island. And I suppose it's hard for us to imagine how so many of the peoples of Europe came to our shores in other days, looking upon this as a great land of promise. And I guess their first rude awakening was when they got to Ellis Island. If you've ever seen the pictures of the situation of the immigrants when they landed there. And many of them, of course, faced the distressing conditions of poverty when they came to this country. They had barriers of language. Many of them, no doubt, were poorly educated. But I still remember my dear old Jewish friend telling me of his arrival in this country, his high hopes, and of a rude awakening which came when he also faced grinding poverty. He went to work in the garment district in New York, but then, as you could well imagine, it's often true of our Jewish immigrants, by dint of sheer ability and hard labor, he himself amassed a fortune in time. But this was characteristic of the situation in New York then, in this area where Rauschenbusch was trying to serve. Well, he tells us, and I think many of us can tune in at this point, that he came to this first pastor expecting hope to save souls in the ordinary religious sense. But he soon discovered that the old-fashioned gospel, taken by itself alone, could not adequately solve the problems of the New York slum. America was prosperous. The wealth of the nation was mounting rapidly. But it was very obvious to him that the people in Hell's Kitchen certainly were not sharing in the good times. When work was plentiful, they were able at least to get along. When it was scarce, they suffered. And he said that when it was not available, and in hard times, they sank into destitution, demoralization, prostitution, and crime. Now, Rauschenbusch, being by nature a deeply sensitive person, lived among these people. He saw their needs. He shared their sorrows. On one occasion, he counted the time when a mother had to lift her carriage before she could find one square yard of grass for her baby's carriage. Now, many of these children died of malnutrition and the indescribable living conditions in the New York tenements. And I think sometimes part of our education ought to be to go to some of these large cities and see for ourselves what the situation actually is. I remember some years ago, I'm not sure I'd be brave enough to do it now, but I took a long stroll through Harlem in New York. I said I wanted to see what the conditions were in this part of the city. Well, I found out. And I think it's very difficult for us living here in our cloistered atmosphere sometimes to realize what the appalling conditions exist in these areas. Well, he saw these children die of malnutrition. He saw an endless procession of men out of work, out of clothes, out of shoes, and out of hope. And this bore down the threshold of his physical energies and tore away his strength. He fell an easy victim to an influenza epidemic raging in New York City during the winter of 1888. Venturing out too early in a blizzard in that year to minister to his sick and needy parishioners, he was again stricken, and as a result, he largely lost his hearing. He was virtually deaf during a good part of his life, his professional life. Well, he was a sensitive man. He was deeply dependent upon his friends. And this deafness, of course, largely shut him off from his fellows and doomed him to physical loneliness in a tragedy bravely borne, but always keenly felt to the very day of his death. Well, the burden of his people always weighed heavily upon his heart. He sought to apply his inherited religious ideas to the conditions he found. But he said, increasingly, they did not seem to fit. He said, obviously, the acceptance of Jesus Christ would bring a certain measure of inner peace and serenity to the individual. But it seems to have had little effect on the whole system that actually threatened the bodies and the souls of people, that would crush and destroy the spirit, and especially the lives of little children. So, he said, he came to this pastor, armed with the gospel of his fathers in what was then called its simplicity, and I hope God, who is merciful and charitable, long ago forgave that person, whoever came up with that phrase, the simple gospel. Well, he said, here he was trying to follow all the traditional pattern of church administration, but he said he and all the other ministers around could not save souls as fast as they were being destroyed in Hell's Kitchen. To use his own language, he said, my social view did not come from the church. It came from the outside. It came from personal contact with poverty when I saw how man toiled all their life long in hard, toilsome labor. And at the end of it, they had almost nothing to show. How strong men begged for work and could not get it in hard times. How little children died. And he said, oh, the children's funerals, how they gripped my heart. That was one of the things I always went away thinking about. Why did the children have to die? Well, Rauschenbusch was deeply affected by all this. So he began to read widely on economic and social matters, to absorb the ideals and ideas of people who felt keenly the problems of the masses of people. He says that before 1886, he had already read the sermons of people like D.L. Moody, Alexander McLaren, J. Hudson Taylor and Henry Drummond. But then he turned from that to read the leading economists of his day. You know, when Fosdick was studying at this, I'll point this out when we deal with him in the next period. When he was studying in New York at Union Seminary, he went over to Columbia and took an MA degree in economics. But it might be very well for us as clergy to read widely and study laboriously in areas other than those that are restricted to our immediate ministry. Well, he read the leading economists. Neither did he neglect the practical measures that lay at hand. He labored diligently to establish playgrounds for the children of the slums and for fresh air centers for the babies. Looking back on that period later, this is what Rauschenbusch had to say. In the early dawn of the social awakening, we young men were groping in the dark. All our Christian institutions had assured us that the new call for social justice was of God, and that the very spirit of the Master was urging us on. But the older brethren, he said, were telling us that the true function of the minister is not to serve fables, but to save the immortal souls of men. Well, here we go again. You see, that's an old story. One told me that these were mere questions of mine or thine and had nothing to do with the gospel. A young missionary going to Africa to an early death implored me, said Rauschenbusch, with tears in his eyes, to dismiss these social questions and give myself, quote, to Christian work. He said such appeals were painfully upsetting. All our inherited ideas, all theological literature, all the practices of the church life seemed to be against us. Well, no doubt his was a lonely voice when he began to raise his voice on behalf of social justice. And he said this criticism of his fellow ministers, including some of his closest friends, the feeling generally prevalent that all this social stuff had nothing to do with the gospel and with religion, forced him back to his Bible to see whether or not they were right. You know, I remember very well when I was a student at Baylor University, I joined the First Baptist Church, and I did for one reason primarily. I enormously admired the minister of that church. He was there 32 years, Dr. J. M. Dawson, Joseph Martin Dawson. He never had anything but a B.A. degree, and he's one of those rare people of whom I would say he's the best argument I know for not going to seminary. But he was way ahead of his time. I remember in 1925, Dr. Dawson gave a series of lectures to the South Carolina ministers on Christ and social change. Here was a man way ahead of his time, and down there in that sea of Texas conservatism, he was viewed with suspicion by a good many. I remember students at Baylor who thought, well, what's going on over there? You know, they didn't quite know what to make of this strange topic. But I found this man to be an enormously stimulating person and preacher. He was a brilliant and gifted man. And he was far ahead of his time. And those lectures were published that he gave on Christ and social change. And they are a real tribute, I think, to a man certainly in the 1920s. He was at 25 when he gave those. Well, Rauschenbusch said that he was forced back to a study of the Bible to see whether or not these critics of his were right. And that's always a good place for us to begin. Well, he discovered the social interest of the prophet and the master's passion for social justice, and he said, as I did this, my convictions were deepened. Well, how can you read the prophets of the Old Testament in any telling sense at all and not come to this conclusion when Isaiah, in the very first chapter, says, cease to do evil, learn to do good, correct oppression, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow? That is as stirring a message on the relationship of worship and ethics as you will find anywhere in the Bible. Well, Rauschenbusch said, we differ from many Christian men and women in our insistence on good institutions. They believe that if only people are personally converted, wrong and injustice will gradually disappear from the construction of society. Let me commend people reading a fine sermon called The Conversion First Hang-Up by a former minister of the Riverside Church in New York. The conversion first hang-up. Well, the problem is, this has been so often one of the hang-ups in the church. If we can simply get people individually converted, then you see we will create a whole ganglion of moral power that will help to reconstruct the world. But you know, that after all finally breaks down. Presumably your church is made up of folks converting people, but that doesn't mean the problems are not there nonetheless. And even if to use a just example, suppose we had a congregation made up of these so-called converted people, these wonderful saints, you know, these angels, all that. After how would these so-called saints, for example, decide on what is a just way for the people in the police and the fire department? Or how would they decide on where a new four-lane highway to be put through? And when you get down to the nitty-gritty, you see, sainthood notwithstanding, this doesn't always confer immediate wisdom for the issue at hand. And the further fact is, when you get down to it, no one of us is ever totally converted. I remember what Howard Thurman said once in the Marsh Chapel in Boston University: there are parts of me that have never heard the gospel. Well, we can all say that. I'm still struggling with a whole lot of the vestiges of original sin, and I've got a lot of inside information on this. after all, we're never totally converted. They're just parts of us, I guess, that really fall under the converting powers of the gospel. Well, Rauschenbusch saw a fallacy in this reasoning. He said, after all you have to do is look at what has happened, and surely you can see the fallacy in this reasoning. He said revival in the South certainly were not followed by the freeing of the slaves. I once heard a man say over at University Chapel, he said, I can break up any revival meeting in the South. All I have to do is bring in a white man. Well, we could get down to it. Think of the situation, certainly a few years ago, that was profoundly true. Well, revival in the North did not ease the pressure of competition in the community or stop speculations in land, said Roger Wood. Now, special work and hard work, he said, have to be done in pointing out a social wrong and taking out a remedy before the righteous purposes of a community can be brought to bear upon it. Well, from these fundamental convictions, namely the necessity of individual regeneration and its complement, the necessity of social reconstruction, Rauschenbusch never departed to the end of his days. After all the work he was doing was simply trying to put together these two fundamental things that are so vital in the religious life of the country. He defined as his difficulty how to find a place under the old religious conception for this notion of changing the world and making it righteous, making it habitable, making it brotherly. Well, with this question still unresolved, he sailed in 1891 for a year of study in Europe, and there he spent some further time in study with the great economist Sidney and Beatrice Webb. There he became interested in Fabian socialism. Now, George Bernard Shaw was a member of the Fabian Society for a while, and the Fabians wrote a good many tracts on the economic questions and problems. They had a serious and sustained concern about all this. While he was in England, he also followed very closely the work of the Salvation Army under General William Booth in the slums of London. But he said that in his judgment, one would have to go deeper than Booth and his army for all the magnificent work they had done. You had to do more, he said, than simply pop up the floor and then allow people to go on with all the concentration of wealth that produced poverty and the slums. He said it's necessary to turn off the spigot, after all. Well, in his year of study in Germany, he concentrated on the teachings of Jesus and on sociology. And it was here, Rauschenbusch said, that he began to see the centrality of the concept of the kingdom of God in the teaching of Christ. He said his teaching centered about it, his life was given to it, his death was suffered for it, and he said, if you ever once see this in the gospel, you cannot unsee it again. Well, in that security he found, or in that idea, he found new security in his impulses. Well, shortly after this time, he resigned his pulpit there in Hell's Kitchen and accepted a chair in a theological seminary. because he saw an opportunity to impress his thoughts and experiences on young people in training for ministry. Well, in 1907, he produced his first great work, Christianity and the Social Crisis. He said he wrote this book, actually, to discharge a debt to one of his parishioners. Now, I don't know exactly what that was. Well, he gave the manuscript to his publishers. He sailed for Europe. He said he had not the remotest notion of whether his ideas would receive any acceptance at all. But to his utter amazement, he came back from his trip abroad to find himself famous almost overnight. He had been catapulted into a position of prominence and leadership in the movement for social Christianity. This happened almost overnight. Well, in that book, that very first book, he propounded five ideas that were to constitute so much of the center of his thinking further along the way. For one thing, he set out the notion here that the kingdom of God wants a social hope for Jesus as well as for his contemporaries. And that this involves not only the redemption of individuals, but the redemption of society. He said Jesus put conduct above ritual. He was concerned with public and was not merely individualistic morality. The second thing he stressed was that Jesus repudiated the idea of bloodshed and violence as a means of achieving the kingdom. Third, he said Jesus thought that this kingdom would come by organic growth rather than by some divine catastrophe. Fourth, he made it not just a Jewish idea, but also a universal kingdom. And then fifthly, and he would give a great deal of attention to this, Jesus taught that this was a present reality. It was not simply a future hope. Now, Roger Bush was wise enough to recognize that there was a lot of division among scholars on the points that he set forth, but anyway, some of these were to be his lifelong loyalty. And he concerned himself with the question, after all, if the social hope was so powerful in the prophets and in Jesus, why has Christianity never undertaken seriously the task of social reconstruction? Well, that's a very pivotal question. He points to such matters as the blighting effect of custom and precedent, the increasing otherworldliness of Christianity, and you know, I think Satan's masterpiece for the sabotage of the church and of the social order is to convince us of the fact that Christianity really has no relevance to social life. I think if he can ever get that over, that he's got it won. And that's why our otherworldly religion, this is why our highly individualistic concept of salvation, that's why we have so much contrast in many of these areas.
I was just thinking, how do we take a quality concept?
The poor soul, here, of course, we begin ourselves here in the reason he says there is a tension in the relationship of the Christian to this world. I mean, Jesus recognizes this, and certainly Paul recognizes the tension. But I think so often we have used the New Testament to buttress a false other world in the gospel. Well, let me take an example. That's the little epistle of John, which is a beautiful piece of writing. Profound as he meant with the life, but he says, love not the world, nor the things in the world. But then he tells what he means, the desire of the flesh, the desire of the eyes, the vain glory of life. But certainly in the early Christian fathers, you have all kinds, Tertullian especially, abounds in this, a kind of otherworldly stress. But I think if we can get somehow or other this notion of escapism, or at least a kind of eschatological postponement of things, once we get this, I think we are in trouble. You know, this is exactly the dimension of the gospel, or at least of Christianity, that so profoundly alienated a person like Camus, the French writer, for example. In fact, one of the tragedies in his case, I think, is that he seems to have been almost obsessed with the notion of otherworldliness that comes into Christianity. And he saw this, of course, as a means of abstracting ourselves from this world and not really being seriously engaged with it. This thing comes up in many, many ways, and it's difficult to know how to deal with it. Well, he says, in the church you had the tendency toward asceticism and monasticism, You have the absorption of religion in sacramentalism and dogma and ecclesiasticism. Let me commend another sermon to you for reading, Dr. Harrington Fowdick's The Peril of Worshipping Jesus. You know, when I read that title, I thought, now, what in the world is the preacher going to say about that? What's wrong with worshiping Jesus? Well, when you get to reading the sermon, you'll find out what it means. But basically, it's this sort of thing. The absorption of Christianity, sacramentalism, dogma, ecclesiasticism, there are many ways by which we disperse or blunt the edge of the gospel, really, in our time. He says, the working people will pass, this was his prophecy, as he saw all this, Robert Bush said, the working people will pass from indifference to hostility and from religious enthusiasm to anti-religious bitterness. I don't know how you feel, but I worry a great deal over the plight of the church in our time. And sometimes I can't decide whether I'm realistic or just getting crotchety in my old age. I don't know what. But somehow or other, I remember what a British preacher said to me, Dr. Stephen Wentworth, who wrote that fine book, The Reformation of Our Worship. He visited with us at Louisville, and he lectured in the classes there. And we were talking about the poor church attendance in Britain. He said, don't worry, we're only about 25 years ahead of you. He said, the time is going to come, probably in America, where you will have people suffering the same thing. Well, I don't mind saying, when I look at what I see around me in the life of the church today, I do not really see among the ones coming on the same sense of church loyalty or enthusiasm for the church that their elders had. Now, heaven knows there's plenty in the institutional church for any of us all. I always think of what Swinburne said, I was glad they accept Jesus Christ, were it not that they left us behind the church. Well, heaven knows that there's plenty of leper spots, as we all know. But I really worry sometimes about the future of the church when this present generation really comes in and supposedly takes over. Well, he charged the ministry. Rauschenbusch was charged the ministry in this way. He said the ministry in particular must apply the teaching function of the pulpit to the pressing questions of public morality. And then he went on to say it must collectively learn not to speak without adequate information. You know, it's very well for us to come to the phrase armed with rightness as well as righteousness, as someone says, Ernest Fremont Biddle. We're not to charge individuals with guilt in which all society shares, not to yield to political partisanship, but to deal with moral questions, said Rauschenbusch, before they become political issues. They must lift social questions to the religious level by faith and practical insight. Well, that was a crackling volume that he wrote. As someone said, it was written with the learning of the scholar, the vision of the poet, and the passion of the prophet. Now, Rauschenbusch believed that ultimately the church would have to recast its system of practical and systematic theology to make room not only for new terminology, but for the aims and the motives and the passions and the philosophies that are summed up in the concept of the kingdom of God. And as you well know, in his later volume on theology for the social gospel, he struggled badly precisely at that point. Well, his second significant published work was Prayers for the Social Awakening. Have you ever seen that? Have any of you come upon it? Don't you think it's a remarkable little volume?
Prayer for me was late little journal.
I hope you'll get hold of this. For one thing, he wrote these prayers, well, he just wrote them all over the country, and he was on railroad trains as he meditated on the problems of people he had seen. And he says, actually, that and if you really want to see something that's wrong with an awareness of the social issues of the time, get hold of these prayers for the social awakening. He says sometimes these would be written in railroad stations while he was sitting there waiting for a train. And there were times, he said, when he was moved to such deep feeling that the tears welled up in his eyes and blotted the paper on which he was writing.
There's another book that's a little more contemporary than that called Prayer to My Voice.
That's right. I have that little volume. It has a lot of references to the situation as well. And it bears something at the same time as sensitivity. Well, several years later, Rauschenbusch continued his publishing with the book Christianizing the Social Order. Now, in this, he recognized some heartening signs of social awakening, even in those citadels of conservatism, he said, which make a specialty of what is seen, and by that, mind you, he meant the denomination of publishing houses and the theological seminary. Well, I'd like to believe that that is not true of us, that we simply want to make a specialty of what is safe, but believe me, it's always dangerously possible that it could be so. Well, he pointed out that the seminaries were beginning to introduce chairs devoted to social ethics or Christian society. I don't know when we really began to introduce in our Baptist seminaries studies in ethics. I don't know, I'm not acquainted that far back, but I remember my first introduction to a course in Christian ethics. They was taught by Dr. Holman Bentley at Louisville when I was there, and it was for the rather strange kind of Christian sociology. But as you would expect from him, it was marked by the very finest insight and the most careful scholarship. Well, he was not blind to the continuing difficulty that he faced in promulgating his views, the innate conservatism of human nature, the active opposition of dominant social classes to changes that would adversely affect them, the power of institutionalized tradition, and often the influence and the weight of the church. Now let me give you a case in point of the latter. You know, one of the things that is so demoralizing and discouraging when you look back in the history of the church, same here at the Bible. Think of the years and the ways in which we buttress our whole social system of racial segregation. My great teacher at Duke, Dr. H. Shelton Smith, wrote a splendid book called In His Image But, which is a beautifully documented and powerfully indicting study of racism in Southern religion for over 100 years. And here he had documented this with words that were spoken by outstanding religious and denominational leaders over our country, and especially here in the South. Now these are people who are well known, and their viewpoints can be documented. I was always shocked out of my history, for example, as a prominent Episcopal clergyman in this state, here in North Carolina, came out saying that, after all, it's not necessary to teach blacks how to read. Simply transmit to them whatever they need to know orally. Now this was an eminent churchman in this state. And this whole study is a very disturbing thing. Well, I think, I guess we'd be a little bit safer if we go far away. Let's take South Africa, for example. I've been doing some reading in this area, and that part of the world is also a disturbing thing. But what bothers me about the South African situation, when you go back into it and look at it, it's almost a precise replay of the situation we had here in the South over the years. And I'm more familiar with this. This is one time where age can have an advantage, because I'll be a little bit more of this than some of you. I can remember so many of them when black was able to push to the back of the bus. One of my early questions as a little boy was to ask my mother one day, "Mama, why do these people have to go back there?" Well, in South Africa today, the thing that is so disturbing to me is that the Dutch Reformed Church, which is the largest, I guess the most dominant church group in South Africa today. The astounding thing is that actually all the atrocious system of apartheid, which has been promulgated on people politically, is also buttressed religiously by the church. And let me give you a case in point. Now, believe it or not, at the World Council of Churches in 1954, a declaration was made which affirmed that any form of racial segregation or discrimination is contrary to the will of God. You will not believe it, but the South African representative of the Dutch Reformed Church refused to sign that document. And in that point of view, they even stood apart from their conservative counterparts in Holland. Now, this is all but a point. If you can go back today, you can read the literature on this. Read something like Trevor Huddleston's Not For Your Comfort. He was an Anglican bishop in South Africa. Now, it's almost appalling that you have, it's always this act where politics and religion come together to buttress something that is inherently wrong. You see, this is the kind of thing, I suppose, in the life of the church that we're always like. And one thing that, if you don't watch, will really discourage you is that real social change is notoriously slow in coming. Now here, think of all these decades that where South Africa has been immersed in this apartheid system. Well, just this week, in the Transvaal province in South Africa, a political leader has been thrust to the floor who is a hardline white supremacist. And so those few little glimmering rays of hope that somehow this old apartheid system can maybe be cracked just a bit have been eclipsed. Here is a man who now has risen second in power and authority in South Africa to the prime minister. They got a new prime minister there. He hasn't been in power for just a few months. And hopefully, there was some hope that maybe through Prime Minister Botha, there would be some kind of breakdown in this old entrenched system. I remember Martin Luther King, when he was in the heyday of his work in the civil rights movement, he made a visit to India. And he said the one thing he learned from his visit to India was how long it takes to bring about social change. He said he and his counterparts here in this country, they've been